Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm very excited about the show today because, you know, there are certain things that you read that you've gotten used to reading and you read in a certain way. Many guests on my show have included members of the New York School. You've heard Ron Padgett, Eileen Miles, Kenward Elmsley, John Ashbery, John Yao, and a new book has come out called Women, the New York School, and Other True Abstractions. It's by Maggie Nelson, who's one of my guests. She is also a poet whose most recent book is Something Bright Than Holes, which is published by Soft Skull Press. The book Women, the New York School, and Other Abstractions is published by the University of Iowa. My second guest is Eileen Miles, who was called by Ted Berrigan the last member of the New York School, who has a new book, Sorry Tree, published by Wave Books. Now, when I started reading Maggie's book, it hadn't occurred to me that after the first generation of the New York School, which had included John Ashbery, Kenneth Koch, James Schuyler, Frank O'Hara, and Barbara Guest, that as this got named as a school of poetry, something really that began to happen when a gallery owner, thinking of the New York School of Painters, thought, well, maybe these chapbooks and pamphlets that I'm publishing by poets would gain attention if I gave it all a name, the New York School. But after that happened, the name stuck, and it became something that drew attention to the poetry. How would you describe the New York School, Maggie, of poetry, given the fact that it doesn't exist?
as a true abstraction, I guess, would be the term, which meaning a you know, an abstract concept that doesn't, in some sense, have any real referent, but in another sense does refer to a set of excitements and place. And Eileen Miles, in the chapter I have in the New York School, says that she's willing to identify with the label if it means learning to be a poet in New York amidst all that excitement and that kind of writing rooted in presence and body. And I support that.
In 1966, the year Frank O'Hara died, the Poetry Project at St. Mark's Church opened its doors, and what was thought to be the second generation of the New York School, which included Ted Berrigan, Ron Padgett, Alice Notley, others, began. Now, this, in a certain sense, can be thought to be merely an academic matter among poets who thought of themselves first and certainly as anti-academic. But again, it was a convenient marketing device, one might say, to bring attention to the poetry. Now, in Maggie Nelson's book, the world of feminist and deconstructive criticism has been brought to bear on certain events that begins by seeing that the New York School of Poets was defined by the male energies of people like Jackson Pollock, and that this helped an enormous number of men. Abstract expressionists were seen as men exploring with their paint their female unconscious, and that the women painters were often, when you see these photographs, there's a room full of men and one woman. And so the book begins with a reading of the painting of Joan Mitchell and the poetry of Barbara Guest. What were the problems they faced?
Partly what's interesting is that part of the stance of a lot of the women at that time was to say that there were no problems. there were no problems at all, which I think was in part and parcel. The problems were so vast and so immense, and there was so little place for them to do what they were doing that they just kind of had to have an attitude of taking up space and art and identities that didn't really exist for them, and just doing it and just doing the work. And so structurally with the criticism, like you say, about these terms about, you know, Pollock going into the feminized unconscious, I mean, we're just structurally not available as terms. Or they were, but they were, you would just have to hammer home the possibility of being a female subject taking on these things. But I think that, I don't think in some sense, I think they didn't have problems doing their work. that wasn't where the problem lay. And the problems would be more mundane about representation, about reception, about homosocial hostilities, things like that. But
So when you, Eileen, came to St. Mark's, which I think you took courses first at Queens College when you came to New York from Massachusetts, and you'd hear about the New York School and the St. Mark's Church, and you found your way there. What was it like for you?
It was terrific because it was in the world. You know, I mean, the whole stance at St. Mark's Church in the 70s was that the people who were teaching the workshops were working artists, which suggested that they weren't. You know, they were just teaching as an extension of their poet identities, rather than say, you know, I mean, I spent 10 seconds at Queens College, but it was very clear that the little guy with the beret on was a professor, you know, and he had a chip on his shoulder against these people at the church. So it was, and also that, you know, you didn't have to apply to get into the workshop. You just had to walk in and sit down.
I think it was all poets welcome.
Yeah,
my understanding.
Totally. Yeah, there was no. It was just like It was an open institution.
And there were classes or workshops.
There were readings. There were a series of readings, and then there were workshops several nights a week. There was a workshop. Alice Nolly taught a workshop, a very famous one that a lot of us were in. Paul Violi taught a workshop. There were three or four workshops running at all times, and so scenes would develop. Friendships. I mean, when we talk about schools, the thing that's so interesting is that even going backwards to, like, O'Hara taught a workshop at the New School. And that's all the people, a lot of the people who get described as a second generation, they were his students, you know? And he decided out of that bunch which ones he liked, which ones got to be friends. Likewise, you know, I met Alice in her workshop and then became like a young acolyte with my can of beer and my poems walking around their house several times before I went to visit on a, you know, a night that wasn't a workshop night. And I became welcome and I became a friend. And it was sort of like how you got to be in the school was you hung out, you know?
And I just say that for me that I can intervene, uh-huh. Just that when I had a girlfriend at the time who knew about Eileen's work and her poetry and had just told me when I was in school, like institution school, I just said, you just got to go to New York and start taking classes with Eileen Miles and just get out of school and go do that. And eventually that's what I did. So Eileen really continued, at least for me, that kind of tradition.
When I started reading you, this is way back with A Fresh Young Voice from the Plains. Do I have that title right?
You do.
Oh, good. And Sappho's Boat.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the Eileen Miles poem was already down.
Uh-huh.
When you came to New York and were writing in the workshops there, did you already know what your voice was like?
You know, it's sort of, I mean, there was a little piece of what it was like there already for sure, you know? And then the thing that was nice about workshops is that you would be sort of guided away from that, and then you could come back with a vengeance, which is kind of what I did. Like, I was sort of actually urged away from personal poems. And so then when I came back around to it, I had a different kind of grasp and a different kind of technique, I guess.
I think that is something that confuses people who even know the school, because insofar as there's any kind of manifesto,
mm-hmm.
there's Frank O'Hara's personism. And it appeared in the New American Poetry, a famous anthology that came out in 1960. And it was taken for a very long time as being the statement. Mm-hmm. And not only the statement, but it seemed to people to be saying that personal poems in which you mentioned your friends and the things you'd been doing today were the credo of that school. So why did they push you away from personal poems?
Because it always is more complicated than that. You know, that if you look at John Ashbery, you think, is that a personal poem? I mean, he's using languages in a million different ways, you know? And yet there's a John Ashbery speech that we recognize in some of the poems, or sometimes simply by the guy who's reading the poems. But obviously, if you look at all the poets who were in that first anthology and the next bunch, there were just so many other approaches. That's why by the time you get to, you know, this is really beside the point, kind of, but by the time you get to language poetry, it's almost nothing that anybody does in a language poem that somebody didn't do in a New York school poem. You know, I mean, they really, it's kind of like, in a way, it's like one long stream of speech or avant-garde, you know?
It's interesting what you say about the language school, because I think the difference, again, you know, interpretation is everything here, was that for the New York school poets, language belongs to the poet. He or she can use it in any way that you can think of, meaningfully, unmeaningfully, with juxtaposition, in collage. Many things can happen in a poem, and what the poet says is a poem is a poem. I think language poetry begins by saying the language isn't ours. It was shaped by a society in an economy that is not ours. It does not belong to us. And our job is to purify the language of the social texts that don't belong to us, that don't represent us, and that plague our existence and prevent us from speaking honestly. So that sense of ownership versus surrender of ownership and trying to make the language somehow obey something other than its social guardians.
I want to hear Maggie respond to this. I felt some quiet energy surging over there.
I don't know. I mean, for at risk of just, you know, taking on the New York School insouciance maybe, you know, too deeply, I think really, to me, it more has to do with a sense of humor. And I think that the New York School, it's not so much about deciding where, who owns language and who, I think it's more about having a sense of humor about the self, and that the New York School can use, like the self can be used as an owner of its language or its feeling, but because the whole idea that we can own anything about language or selfhood or the world is all kind of a joke. So there's not the same anxiety about speaking from a first person because that kind of flow is a given. Whereas I think with, maybe I would recast what you say about language poetry, not so much that there is like a true self that these language structures are obscuring or barring access to because they're not ours, but rather that there's too much anxiety about what the idea of speaking from a self is, that it's decided that you can't, we're better off not using it, I guess.
I think in part also it's a matter of time, that in the 50s and 60s there was a huge belief that you could steal language from poetry as we had known it, mm-hmm. and reshape it to be triumphant and exalted, mm-hmm. funny, thrilling, anything you wanted. I think language poetry comes at a different point of America, where already you have all these ecstatic and wonderful, thrilling poems, but they haven't in some way change the world. Mm. And in a certain sense, there's the feeling that another generation didn't get us out of Vietnam. We got out of Vietnam when we were forced to, when it wouldn't happen anymore. And that the poem with the language of people who are trying to re-win some language that you could talk to dominant culture in that would not be dictated by dominant culture.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how mm-hmm. I understand it, which is not to say that at the same time in New York, the New York school is creating its own response to the sense that the world is not going to belong to us, that dark reality starts to creep into what was the incredible optimism of a Frank O'Hara poem or a Kenneth Koch poem, the sense that walking down the street, what you see belongs to you because you can describe it and put it in a poem. It's yours. And its stance and energy and enthusiasm, Eileen, I see. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm just thinking about the time that work was being made and the sense that perhaps that the heaviness and the politicalness of the time was being carried by the Beats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think they were all kind of like bartering and bouncing tribes of people mm-hmm. making poems.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a sense that, you know, like I remember Frank O'Hara's famous quote about being too square for the Beats and mm-hmm. too beat for the square, you know, that he was sort of a negotiating person. It's true, I think, what you say about the Vietnam War and a generation that had a different kind of articulation, and also the rise of theory and it not being a bad thing
Absolutely.
To be an intellectual. I mean, mm-hmm. it's sort of like there was a real mm-hmm. need to be libidinal and prove that you were pleasure-seeking in the mm-hmm. 60s and 70s, you know? And I think by the late 70s and the 80s, there was a different cultural constriction and less opportunity to speak, and yet there was this new medium to speak through and a new lingo for intellectuals. And language poets, I think, were the first poets to take that on.
Mm-hmm.
And also AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
The change in libidinal energy brought about by that sense of how do I approach the mm-hmm. sexual, the sensual,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In a world where something is now out of my control.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the body is not a big figure in language poetry.
That's right. That's right. And stance also, you know, attitude
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kind of disappears from language poetry in part with identity. I don't think these are poets who are trying to say who they are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also the heroic, which brings us back to male and female.
Exactly.
You know.
Well, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Eileen Miles, author most recently of Sorry Tree, published by Wave Books, and Maggie Nelson, who has written a book about women, the New York School, and other true abstractions, published by the University of Iowa Press, and is herself a poet, author most recently of Something Bright Than Holes, published by Soft Skull Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Eileen Miles and Maggie Nelson about the New York School. Now, Maggie, many of the people that you quote in the book are talking about this in theoretical ways, with titles like The Sex Which Is Not a Sex, or Goose Irigawa, is that
Irigawa. Mm-hmm.
Irigawa. Say it again.
If only I were French, I could say it well, but yeah, Irigawa.
She says that the category female does not exist. And you trace in the book what you might call first true abstraction, i.e. women exist, but the abstract quality, woman, does not exist, or vice versa. But there's a kind of poetics where the personal becomes both the universal on the one hand and the anonymous. And so in Bernadette Mayer's book, she writes a book over a single day, and it's going to say all the things she's done on that day, it's going to contain a lot of trivial things that everyone does, but by being things that everyone does mm-hmm. in a family, mm-hmm. raising children, having everyone around, it becomes what no one does. It becomes anonymous work. Mm-hmm. And that tracing of the strong identity, the transcendent identity with the non-identity mm-hmm. seems part of what you're talking about, mm-hmm. about female poetics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the book was, you know, it was fun but also frustrating to write because, you know, I wanted to write about women in the New York school, the reason why it has such an unwieldy title is just because, you know, very quickly into that inquiry, both categories just seem fairly useless, really, because, like Eileen says, if the female, whatever that is a space that has to be recreated over and over again, you know, so is a school, so is friendship, so is a poetic, so is all these things. So if that's the case, how on earth do you try and write something critical that addresses that without being hopelessly vague, but that also doesn't tether that down? And I think that, you know, what's great about Bernadette Mayer's book that you're talking about, Midwinter Day, is that I quote a story where a journalist is over interviewing her husband and asking about his poetry and how he writes and all these things. And then she looks over at Bernadette, and Bernadette has her two kids, Marie and Sophie, crawling on her. And the journalist says very condescendingly to her, "Oh, you're a poet too? When do you get a chance to write?" And that kind of answer of Midwinter Day is a surprising one, which is, "I write all day long, and I put whatever in the poem, whatever flood of details in the poem that I want to be in the poem," and kind of refusing this idea that to make this kind of rarefied female or male space that's apart from life. So I think that allows for a certain flow that I think is important, you know.
When you say that the thing that is female has to be reinvented over and over again, is that equally true of poetry?
Yeah.
And that's what, I mean, yeah. I think that's what
yeah.
it's
that's a, the link, really.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful one. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, you want to go into theory, it's like Judy Butler has a thing called a lesbian phallus. Mm-hmm. And I think it refers exactly to that, mm-hmm. you know, that there's a kind of...
Yeah, because Judy Butler's famous phrase, which is, you know, that gender is a imitation for which there's no original, that could be seen as depressing. It could also be seen as granting enormous permission and exploration and possibility, and I think that the best poetry exists in that place.
When I was starting out knowing and talking to writers after I left school, you know, because school doesn't define anything. Anyone can say anything then, and it's theoretical. But suddenly I was among writers like Dennis Cooper or Amy Gersler, and Dennis said to me, "You find your subject and your voice, and then you stick to it." That's Warhol, that's Ashbery, that's O'Hara, that a whole career is spent finding new variants on your central presence, and that if you find your voice and who you are early, you're very lucky, because to be seen floundering with changing subjects is to diffuse your effectiveness. I think that's true of Eileen's work, very strong voice, and you recognize it, and it grows and it swells. But I think that your instance is something different, that it's now possible, and I think really healthy, for a young writer to take on, to do a project, complete the project, maybe not finish it, but just draw it to a close and move on to the next thing without having to repeat, extend, do a variant on.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that I came up in I think Eileen and other people, you know, who taught me other things stand apart from this, but, you know, I came up in a moment where there was a lot of distinction between theory and criticism and creative writing. It was not one that I ever felt personally with myself. It didn't make any sense to me. I didn't have that. So to me, I don't think of it as kind of taking on completely other personas. I mean, to me, the flow of ideas through my work is very the same, but I understand and I appreciate when I work in different genres that they have their own logics and kind of rules. And, you know, some things, I mean, argumentation is a totally different animal than, being in the present moment of a site-specific poem, which is a totally different animal than a research project, which is a totally different animal than an art review. And so I feel like you have to learn about those different skins to inhabit them. But I don't think, but voice to me, I mean, I believe in the psychoanalytic truism that, you know, one's trying to become a stranger to oneself rather than always become known. And so maybe that might translate into why I'd like to experiment with these different spaces. So.
I mean, I think that when I think about Maggie's work and my observation of it over a period of time, I think one of the things that's always been distinct and kind of interesting and kind of groundbreaking about who you are and how you make work is from very early on, I saw you as having no conflicts about varying roles mm-hmm. as a writer, that no problem being an academic and getting a PhD, no problem being a poet, no problem being a poet with a very intense personal story in your family to tell that you, once you found a way to tell it as a poet, it became, you know, like a novel in poetry. And no problem moving from there to a nonfiction work about that same. I mean, it's like you just keep. So I see it as being very versatile, having an enormous amount of energy and intelligence and possibility, and not having conflicts about, no, that's not me. No, that's not me. And I do think, I mean, I don't identify too much with the maybe the use of the word voice as a part of my writing. I just know that, like, I think in terms of energy and presence and maybe in terms of vocabularies, you know, because growing up with a sense that being working class wasn't necessarily going to produce a writer meant that I had one vocabulary and then another one in the poetry world and another one in the art world and another one as a dyke and putting all those languages and being an intellectual since I was a child and putting those all together at a certain rate of speed that I experienced myself at, you know, becomes the Eileen voice perhaps, but not to me because all I know is these moods and speeds that I'm charging from the inside.
I've been speaking with Eileen Miles, the author most recently of Sorry Tree, published by Wave Books, her most recent book of poetry, and Maggie Nelson, author most recently of Something Bright Then Holes, a book of poetry published by Soft Skull Press. In a sense, the occasion is a book by Maggie Nelson called Women, the New York School, and Other True Abstractions, in which there is a chapter on Eileen Miles, and this book is published by the University of Iowa Press. Thank you for joining me. You can read excerpts from these books at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.